silver wedding celebrations.
You really want to celebrate that?
Well, of course I do, don't you?
Things begin to unravel when a figure from their past returns.
Did Edgar have anything to do with me losing custody of my children?
Oh, Kurt. It's all so long ago.
Starring Robert Glenister and Hattie Morahan.
She's just angry because I didn't die last night.
No, I'm angry because you didn't die 25 years ago.
The Dance of Death in Drama on 3. This evening at 7:30 on Radio 3 and BBC Sounds.
Powerful stuff. It's midday and time for Private Passions, and Michael Barclay's guest is the lawyer and campaigner Helena Kennedy.
Brought up in a Glasgow tenement flat, Helena Kennedy was the first in her family to go to university. But instead of going to Glasgow University to read English and becoming a teacher as they had expected, she startled everyone by travelling to London to study for the bar. Some of her friends misunderstood and thought she'd gone south to work in a pub. This was the end of the 60s, a time when there were extremely few women barristers. Since then, her ambition, fierce intelligence and considerable charm have taken her right to the top, and she now sits in the House of Lords as Baroness Kennedy of the Shores. She created a huge stir when she published her first book, Eve Was Framed, in 1992, a shocking examination of how the criminal justice system fails women. 3 years ago, she felt that so little had changed that she published a sequel, a book with the title Miss Justice. Helena Kennedy campaigns now on wider human rights issues, such as the persecution and murder of women in Iran and the shocking genocide of the Uyghurs in China. Well, there's a lot to discuss, Helena, but let's get to the music, because we've Handel, Bach, Schubert, James McMillan, George Benjamin. We're going to start, though, with Puccini and Mimi's famous aria from La Bohème. Why this?
I was brought up in a household, I'm afraid, that we didn't have music. I didn't really know anything very much about classical music until I came to study. And by being with people who'd had a much sort of more musical education, I was introduced to music. And I had a great friend, Angelica Mitchell, and her parents were serious intellectuals, and they used to go to the opera, and I would be invited along. And this was one of the first operas that I remember being introduced to. And Angelica and I were up in the gods. Her parents were sitting in more handsome seats. But I remember that we had to meet up in the Crush Bar and I fainted. But this was really my introduction to music that I was not familiar with. And I fell in love with this particular aria.
Well, in this aria, Mimi talks of her life as a poor seamstress. She says she's calm and happy, stitching away in a small attic room. I wonder if there's something in that, actually, which is a sort of parallel for you.
I lived in lots of small attic rooms, I have to tell you. And it was pretty hand-to-mouth in those... I mean,
Poor area of Glasgow.
Yes, and I lived on a grant when I came down to London, and it was very tough. And when I started at the bar, I mean, and I was going to do pupillage, I had no idea how I was going to be able to fund it. And the bank that... the Bank of Scotland, I'm going to name and shame it, said to me, "You must be joking. A woman going to the bar and you've no collateral, you've nobody to guarantee an overdraft or anything like that. I'm terribly sorry," and showed me the door. And it was really because I had a lovely boyfriend at the time whose father, John Harvey, had been a Conservative Member of Parliament, who was a very, very decent and good man. And he said, "I would be happy to guarantee your overdraft, Helena, but you'd have to move to my bank." And I went to the bank and I met his bank manager, Mr. Thompson. And Mr. Thompson listened to me, this little enthusiastic person, saying why I was going to change the world. And he said, "You don't really want Mr. Harvey to be your guarantor. You'd rather go it alone, wouldn't you?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, "I think you're going to be fine at the bar." And he gave me an overdraft with no guarantee attached.
Well, here is Mimi dealing with her life of poverty at that time from La Bohème.
Mi, 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 mi.
Mirella Freni with that aria from the first act, Puccini's La Bohème, Giuseppe Sinopoli conducting the Philharmonia Orchestra. Well, clearly, Helena Kennedy, the bank manager recognised you had considerable ambition. Where do you think the drive came from?
I think the drive came from my own mother. My mother was a really redoubtable character and a great person in the centre of our community, which was the Catholic community of South Glasgow. And she taught us one important lesson, which was you must never treat anybody as less than you, but nobody's better than you.
But the idea of going into the law was very much because your background suggested that people were frightened of the law.
Yes, except that my father was a trade union representative. I mean, he was in what was called the print. He was a dispatch hand with a Scottish newspaper. And so he ended up being the father of the chapel there, as they called the person who, you know, was the representative. And he often dealt with people who had industrial injuries and people who had problems where they needed compensation. And sometimes it was a real battle. And so I became aware of the fact that the court system could both be a producer of good outcomes while at the same time being a rather intimidating and sometimes a repressor of people.
Studying for the bar in London meant entering a very different world. It's still a cloistered place with its own traditions and peculiar costumes. How did it strike you when you arrived there in the late 60s? What were your impressions?
It was extraordinary. It was like stepping into an Evelyn Waugh novel. And everyone spoke with those BBC tones that I had only ever heard on the radio. And so I assumed that everybody was so much more clever than I was. It took me a while to realise that sometimes appearances and great vocal, tones can give you the impression of intelligence and smarts.
I think I'm going to have to temper my accent.
You don't have to.
Music, which I think reminds you now of your time as a student, because it's from a soundtrack, isn't it? A 1968 film?
Yes, it's from the film of If, Lindsay Anderson's famous film, which is set in a public school. And all the young men I knew who'd gone to those grand schools and who introduced me to so much about the arts and about music and so on, they were very ambivalent. It was a period when most of them actually were quite left-wing. They were rebelling against their establishment background. And this film was very much challenging what was going on in public schools. And all of them wanted to see this film. And I went with a group of my friends who were, you know, doing their bar finals from Oxbridge and so on. And they reveled in this film, which was, of course, I mean, so outside of my experience. But the music was fantastic. And of course, it was a Catholic mass. And as a Catholic girl from the south side of Glasgow, sacred music was something that I was familiar with.
Well, it's a setting from 1958 of the Latin mass using styles traditional to the Democratic Republic of Congo and composed by a Franciscan friar from Belgium, Father Guido Hazen.
Wonderful. Yeah. I think it was one of the first LPs that I bought. I loved it, the music so much.
The Sanctus from Missa Luba by Father Guido Hazen. We heard the original 1958 recording of Les Troubadours de Roi Baudouin, used by Lindsay Anderson in his film, If, which of course made a star of Malcolm McDowell, didn't it?
It really did, yes.
That music takes you to your time studying law, Helena Kennedy. When you started practising, what kind of work did you find yourself doing? your first case, for example, and the impact it made on you?
Well, I started off, I did my pupillage with quite traditional chambers, but it was very clear that I wasn't going to be taken on, and very few people were, and the clerks in chambers usually weren't very enthusiastic about women. And it was a time when they could say, we don't take women. It was before the Sex Discrimination Act. And then when the Sex Discrimination Act came in, they would say, we've got one, when it came to the business of women. So I knew that I was not going to be taken on. And I don't know where this came from. It was almost innocent. But I got together with five other people. It was three men and three women. And we set up a new set of chambers. And it was unheard of at the time. It was in some ways quite ludicrous because it came out of an innocence of saying, well, why don't we set up our own chambers? And I have to make a confession that I stole a notice that was on a notice board in Middle Temple Lane saying two rooms available, suitable as an annex for some grand set of chambers. And so I took the drawing pin out of it and stuck it in my pocket, and we applied, and nobody else applied, strangely, and we got the rooms. And so we set up. We were all mainly young people who had gone to state schools, grammar schools and so on. We weren't from the traditional background. And there were three women, as I say, and most of our work came from the law centres, which were just being created at that time. You know, it was poor man's law, as my mother would have called it. And the first case I ever did was as a pupil in my second 6 months. And it was to represent a woman who was sent to prison. I mean, it's a bad story. In my first case, my client went to prison and she had a suspended sentence hanging over her head, and it was for shoplifting. And she was a repeat shoplifter. But she was a woman who had been abused and whose life was wretched, and she had these young children. And the madness of her being sent off to prison when her children then were going to have to, I mean, she begged me to phone her friend to take the children so they wouldn't be taken into care. And it was the whole tragedy of poverty.
How much are you affected by cases like this emotionally? What kind of strategies have you developed not to get too depressed by them?
There are times when I think when it's hard, but I have learned over the years, and you've got to remember I've practiced at the bar now for 50 years, I've learned how to compartmentalise it. And I've learned that music is one of the ways in which you can step out of that painful stuff and be reminded of the great beauty of our world, of the sublime nature of what humanity can create.
Well, it's Handel next, actually, and the lovely opening aria from his opera Xerxes, Ombra Mai Fu, a hymn of praise to a plane tree. Where did you discover this?
I was introduced to Handel by my husband. And Ian, who's a surgeon and again takes great relief from music, he loves this aria. And so I got to know it really, and got to know Handel's operas through him.
Mm. You met Ian because you went to A&E with very bad face paint, didn't you?
I did. I met my husband because I was doing a big case arising out of the Irish Troubles, and it was the first time I was really leading on my own, and I was still in my early 30s, and it was due to start the following week, and I had this desperate pain in my face, and I thought I must have an abscess at the root of a tooth or something. And I went to the dentist, he sent me to the hospital. I go to the hospital and I'm put in front of this facial surgeon. He's a senior registrar, and it turned out that I had acute sinusitis and so I was given antibiotics. And he and I had a great conversation and so on, and he said, I've often wanted to go to court. And so I gave him my phone number, and I didn't hear from him certainly well over a month, 6 weeks or something. But it turned out that you're not allowed to
solicit
be interested in anybody who's been a patient, and he had to wait until I was out of the system before he contacted me. So there began a great romance in the University College Hospital when I had sinusitis.
Yes. And the unusual thing about that romantic story is that you already had a child at that time.
Yes, I did. I lived with an actor, Ian Mitchell, for, 7 years, and we had a son together. But our relationship didn't survive. And so I was on my own with my little son, and with a very busy practice and very demanding work. And it was a painful time, I have to say. And then I met this wonderful man.
Also called Ian.
Isn't that extraordinary? No mistakes can be made. And we married, and we've had two more children, and I've had a very, very wonderful and happy life with him.
Did he cure the sinusitis?
He has never cured my sinusitis, let me tell you. It's a feeling that I bring up quite regularly.
Well, let's hear Ombra Mai Fu, which he introduced to you. the March Mist Lorraine Hunt Lieberson performing Ombre My Fou, from Handel Xerxes, Harry Bickett directing the Orchestra of the Age of Enlightenment. I want to take you back to the early 90s, Helena, if I may, when you'd been practicing for about 20 years and you published this book which I mentioned, which had such a huge impact, Eve Was Framed. It's about how women were being failed by the legal system, particularly women who suffered sexual assault, because they felt so ashamed that they couldn't go to the police.
And that business of not being believed and the sense of shame that surrounded being the victim of abuse, even of domestic violence, that women felt that somehow it must have been their fault. Why does it happen to me? And that somehow they failed in their womanhood in addition to anything to do with anything else. And so it was really interesting to me. The more I did these cases, and the point came during the late 80s into the 90s, certainly after I took Silk and became a Queen's Counsel, I started doing a lot of homicides of women who ended up snapping after years of abuse and defending them. And it was very difficult to get acquittals because very often it looked very premeditated, you know, that she waited for a moment to run at him with a knife or while he was drunk or whatever. And the understanding of what the long-term impact of abuse could take on people was really not understood. And I'd started doing a lot of work with a wonderful psychiatrist, Nigel Eastman, looking at the interface of law and psychiatry. And we started trying to see whether we couldn't create an understanding in the courts of what is now called post-traumatic stress disorder. The idea that the impact of trauma on people and repeated trauma could be really devastating to their mental health. And then getting it to fit into legal definitions, which was difficult because for manslaughter, you need diminished responsibility and that involves an abnormality of mind. And did this constitute an abnormality of mind? And so I became very interested in doing those cases and I did a lot of them. And a lot of judges used to, if they saw me talking to their wives, they got very worried. I really decided that I wanted to really address this in a much more public way. I remember doing a radio interview with Michael Argyle, who was a judge at the Old Bailey. And as we came out and he was saying, there's no, we do anything different for women at all, and was very dismissive of this. And when we got into the lift, he said to me, Helena, I don't want you to think that I'm against women. I voted for them to join the Kennel Club.
You revisited some of these issues, not the Kennel Club, 25 years on in your recent book, Miss Justice. And reading it, I sense a tone of real frustration because there's not been that much progress.
The book that I wrote in 2018 was revisiting many of those issues. It was a new book, but it was really saying, have we really come that far? Or are women throwing a brick through the windows of the criminal justice system around the world and saying, the social contract says, bring me your wrongs, the things that happened to you, and we will deal with them. And then they don't deal with them. And I think social media has disinhibited, particularly men, to be abusive. And then it travels onto the streets. And so you now hear women saying they can be the frightened of being at a bus stop late at night because of the kind of abuse and propositioning and fear that's induced in them by conduct that is, I think, has been affected by the disinhibition that comes with the social media.
We're going to the more tranquil setting of the Sistine Chapel for our next music. For James McMillan's Stabat Mater, this is Mary's Lament for the Dead Christ.
Yes, I have a great friend, John Straczynski, who's a philanthropist. And this was a commission he gave to Sir James McMillan, who's a great Scot and a wonderful composer. And this piece of music had its premiere in the Sistine Chapel. And John invited friends and people if they wanted to come. And we, Ian and I, travelled to Rome, where we married, actually. Mm. And it was so sublime, Michael, to be in the Sistine Chapel and to hear this piece of exquisite and wonderful music. And with us was someone who had only recently lost a son. And so it was that evocation of loss, and particularly of a child. It doesn't matter what age you are, but somehow there's something that is not in the natural order that your child dies before you. And it was one of the great musical experiences in my life.
Music from the opening of James Macmillan's Stabat Mater, with Harry Christophers conducting the 16 and the Britten Sinfonia. A musical voice, Helena Kennedy, very much informed by quite passionate belief, isn't it, in his case?
Oh yes. I mean, he's a very devout Catholic. I'm a very rebellious Catholic. but he does write exquisite pieces.
You can find details of all of the music of my guest today, Helena Kennedy, if you go to the Private Passions webpage. And if you go to BBC Sounds, there are also hundreds of programmes to download. Well, that's the second piece of sacred music you've chosen, Helena, and it stems, as we were saying, from James's Catholic faith. You were brought up in a devout Catholic family.
Yes.
And how much has that continued to be an influence on you?
I have absolutely no doubt that my values were very much, you know, embedded in me as a child about our responsibility to other people and our sense of compassion and forgiveness and the things that I believe are part and parcel of the teachings that I was brought up with. But I feel very strongly as a feminist that the Catholic Church has still not got it right around issues to do with sexuality, sex itself, and its important place in our lives, and somehow it's still sort of there in that sort of dark corner. And I'm afraid that I feel very strongly that there isn't enough democracy in the Catholic Church.
Is the concept of prayer, and indeed Mass and things like that, is that still important to you?
Yes, I'm not someone who goes to Mass every single Sunday, but I do find a great deal of solace in ritual, which is probably why I quite like the law too, and some of the stuff that goes on in the House of Lords. But I do actually find that periods for reflection and meditation are quite important.
Well, that takes me very nicely to a great source of spirituality. Indeed, I think of him as God, Bach.
Oh, I mean, whenever I'm asked to choose a piece of music, I so often turn to the Bach cello suites. And I can't honestly remember when I was first introduced to them, but I suspect it was in the 70s. And they are, for me, the place to go when one is desirous of internal examination and time and reflection. And when I've had loss, when my mother died, I found it very, very helpful to be in a quiet place with Bach. Thank you.
Alyssa Weilerstein with the prelude to the fourth cello suite in E-flat major by Johann Sebastian Bach. The cases we've talked about so far, Helena, have often involved women who are really victims of their circumstances, often victims of poverty. Now, I know all barristers are asked this, but it still remains an interesting question. How do you live with the possibility of your clients being guilty? I mean, you're not always defending the innocent. You acted for the child murderer Myra Hindley, for instance, when she was caught trying to escape prison.
Well, Myra Hindley was undoubtedly a manipulative person who committed grievous crimes. But as so often happens, you meet someone who has done the most wicked and dire things, and they too have parts of themselves that are essentially very human. And so in my interactions with her, she wanted to talk about books. You know, I was in my 20s. She wanted to know what I was reading, because that was how she survived in prison, was that she did a degree, an Open University degree. She was doing English literature. She wanted to talk about Middlemarch. she really wanted to have an interaction with somebody who she thought might also be interested in the things that she had become interested in. So, you know, people are complex. But the crimes were horrifying. And I have to honestly tell you that I deliberately avoided going back and reading about what she had done while I was interacting with her, because I didn't want to be carrying that with me into those consultations in preparation for the hearings.
Also, if one's going to believe in a redemptive system, one must offer some element of hope.
Absolutely. And I see myself as there protecting the system. And I often have to say to people, you know, we need to make sure that people are properly defended in the way that they would defend themselves if they were knowledgeable of the law and so on, because the system is there for all of us. And that's what we're protecting.
But that becomes even more worrying, the need for that defence, if our criminal system is almost at breaking point, with huge delays in trials, barristers leaving because the rates of legal aid pay are so low. How true is it that to become a criminal barrister now, you really have to have an alternative source of income?
I mean, it's been so shocking that 40% was taken out of the justice budget, you know, and that's because justice for most people is invisible. It doesn't happen to you. And yet, the legal system is a tapestry. And once you start, fraying it away over there in the corner that does criminal law, you're really damaging the whole thing.
Mm-hmm. How are young people to become criminal barristers, given the pay, as against London rents and rates?
It's almost impossible. And what we do in my chambers is that we encourage the young to have a more diverse practice, so that they do a certain amount of civil litigation as well as criminal work, so that you rob Peter to pay Paul. But that shouldn't be necessary, because gaining expertise in a particular field is really important. But you can't start people off if you're not letting them earn enough to make a living.
Mitsuko Ushida next, another wonderful woman artist, playing Schubert's Sonata in A Major, Deutsch 664. And you've chosen this really because of her personality and how it infuses her music making.
Yes, I met Mitsuko and then we had lunch together. We arranged to have lunch. And I realised just what an extraordinary person she is. She does incredible work, you know, in developing the talents of young musicians, and runs a programme in Vermont, such a summer school, where she brings young musicians and works with them. But when we were having that lunch, she wanted to talk to me about the events that happened during the Second World War, when the Japanese army made use of what were called comfort women in Korea. And it was really a euphemism for forced prostitution. And Mitsuko was very clear that she wanted a reckoning with that past. And I then went off and I listened with great care to her music and her playing. And I realised that sense of something, there's something about Mitsuko. She is compassionate, and the humanity of the woman comes through in her playing. But also there's a sort of fierceness with which she also attacks her music. And I like all of that in a woman. I like all of that in a man too.
We heard the slow movement from Schubert's Piano Sonata No. 13 in A Major, Deutsch 664, performed by Mitsuko Ushida. We've talked a great deal about your career at the bar, Helena Kennedy, but I think we shouldn't forget the wider picture and your work on human rights across the world. One of the human rights abuses which you've been campaigning against is the genocide of the Uyghur people in China. You've actually been personally sanctioned by the Chinese government. But do you think that the government more generally here ought to be doing more? And if so, what can it do?
Of course, one of the problems is that there's a desperate seeking of greater trading opportunities around the world post-Brexit. And so there's an unwillingness to really fall out with the Chinese. But I do think that, you know, if you're going to be the place that's looked to because it's of its commitment to the rule of law, as we in Britain think of ourselves, and protectors of the human rights tradition and international law, then you really have to speak out when a nation is doing what's happening to the Uyghur in Xinjiang province. Because they are being put into really concentration camps, re-education camps. There's forced labour going on in there, and there's evidence of that. There's evidence of the removal of mosques, of burial grounds, of the because the people are Muslim. And children being taken away and put into sort of the equivalent of borstals or training places to turn them into good Chinese, as distinct from their own cultural traditions. And what's happened to women has been appalling too, because they've forced abortions, they've forcing sterilisation. And I know now many of the Uyghur people, and particularly women, in exile. And what they describe is just can't be described as anything other than the trajectory towards genocide. And our duty under the Genocide Convention is to prevent a genocide. You don't wait until it's all over. You don't wait until there are mass graves. You actually prevent it happening. And certainly, I think that we should be considering our position as a trading partner of a nation that's doing that. And we should be having those discussions very loudly and clearly with China.
Have you ever been personally afraid to speak out, or perhaps afraid on behalf of your family and children? I mean, have you ever felt threatened?
No, I can't honestly say that I've ever felt fearful for my own safety. Though my children are all sanctioned by the Chinese too. And as young adults, I mean, one of my sons is a filmmaker, so it could have implications for him.
But so none of them have followed you into the law?
No, I have not at all. No. A filmmaker and a doctor. And a person who runs a personal training business. Yeah.
Well, we're going to end with music that represents, in some ways, your work on human rights, because this is from George Benjamin's Written on Skin, his powerful 2012 opera about a woman fighting a violent and abusive, powerful man.
For me, I can't deny that it has a particular resonance with my work, because we're seeing around the world just now the rise of authoritarianism, and in so many places, people who are exercising power in the most abusive and terrible ways. And that's what this opera's about.
Yes, because Barbara Hannigan sings Agnes, who mm-hmm. decides with her lover that they're going to destroy her hugely abusive husband. So it is someone singing out against the power of tyrants.
Oh, absolutely. And I'm not going to give away the full horror of what the tyrannical husband does to in relation to the lover, but it's about the stuff that I've been working on over the last years, both domestically, the ways in which a powerful person can control the life of someone else and create a context of such fear that you really are enslaved, and then the way in which that happens within nations too. And we're seeing it in places that are not far from home.
Well, as we listen to George Benjamin's moving protest against abusive power, it only remains for me to say thank you very much, Helena Kennedy.
Oh, Michael, I've had the most lovely time with you. Thank you.
Puts on her shoes, steps through the storm, sleeps.
Music from the second act of George Benjamin's Written on Skin with the soloist Barbara Hannigan and Bajan Mehta. The composer himself was conducting the Mahler Chamber Orchestra. And that was the final choice of Michael Barclay's guest on Private Passions today, Helena Kennedy. The episode was produced by Elizabeth Burke and it was a Loftus Media production for BBC Radio 3. And you can find details of all today's music if you search for Private Passions on BBC Sounds. The programme returns next Sunday at noon when Michael's guest will be the actor Robert Powell. BBC Radio 3 on 90 to 93 FM, digital radio, BBC Sounds, and on most smart speakers, just ask for BBC Radio 3. It's 1 o'clock, time for the news, read by me, Jane Royce. Exiled officials from the devastated Ukrainian city of Mariupol have condemned Vladimir Putin's surprise visit, calling him an international criminal. It's the Russian president's first venture into Ukrainian territory since he launched the invasion last year. Images aired on Russian media show him driving around various districts and inspecting a newly built residential building. His trip comes 2 days after the International Criminal Court issued an arrest warrant for Mr. Putin. He's accused of forcibly deporting Ukrainian children to Russia, which is a war crime. The biggest bank in Switzerland, UBS, is in advanced talks to buy all or part of its rival, Credit Suisse, whose shares have fallen sharply in recent days because of worries about its future. An emergency £45 billion lifeline from the Swiss National Bank couldn't resolve the issue. A deal could be announced before the markets open again tomorrow. The BBC understands that John Lewis is at the early stages of changing its staff-owned business model to attract new investment. The company has been 100% owned by staff for more than 70 years, but it's reported by the Sunday Times to be exploring altering its mutual structure to raise new investment. A powerful earthquake off the coast of Ecuador has killed at least 13 people and injured nearly 400 others. The 6.8 magnitude quake was felt in northern Peru, where a young girl died after her home collapsed. The leader of the Liberal Democrats, Sir Ed Davies, says that Britain must tear down trade barriers with Europe if the economy is to prosper again. He also highlighted his commitment to causes such as overseas aid and tackling rising living costs during a speech to his party's spring conference in York. Football and the League Two side Grimsby Town are just over an hour away from their first FA Cup quarter-final for over 80 years. They take on Brighton, who are seventh in the Premier League. The BBC's coverage of the game won't be hosted by Gary Lineker. The presenter, who was recently taken off air during an impartiality row, has jokingly tweeted to say he's been silenced by a cold. The weather, a mainly dry and bright day with some sunny spells. Temperatures will reach 13 degrees Celsius in London, 11 in Cardiff and 10 in Belfast and Edinburgh. And that's the BBC News. It's 1:02.
Get lost in Radio 3's classical mixtape.
It's a 30-minute curated music mix taking you from the day to the evening.
Featuring classical favourites alongside musical surprises.
Helping you shake off the day and take time out.
Radio 3's Classical Mixtape.